This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli in for Terry Gross. In the 70s, the Z-Boys, a team of skateboarders from Santa Monica, invented the moves that turned skateboarding into a phenomenon. Stacy Peralta was one of them. The Z-Boys got their name from the Zephyr Skate Shop, which sponsored the team. In 2001, Peralta's documentary about these pioneers of skateboarding, Dogtown and Z-Boys, won the Audience Award and Director's Award at Sundance. Now, Peralta has written a film dramatizing the Z-Boys' story called Lords of Dogtown. It premieres next week. In this scene, from the upcoming film, not the documentary, the Z-Boys have begun to hit it big. Skater Tony Alva is approached by Beverly Hills Playboy Topper Burks about cashing in.
Hey, Tony. I'm Topper Burks. I know who you are, dude. Skip warned me about you. I bet he did.
How much are these?
More than your car.
I don't own a car, dude.
Exactly. With your talent and my money, I can make you a star.
Terry Gross spoke to Stacy Peralta in 2002.
Stacy Peralta, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Describe your part of the ocean when you were surfing. Let's talk about the surfing, and then we'll get to the skateboarding.
Well, we grew up in West Los Angeles in an area which is basically South Santa Monica, Ocean Park, and North Venice. And it was given the nickname back in the 70s of Dogtown. At that time, it was pretty much a rundown piece of coastline, what we used to refer to as, you know, the seaside slum, or where the debris meets the sea. And it was not a world-class surf break, so to become a good surfer there, you had to work very, very hard because the waves were not as good as, say, like in Hawaii or, say, up in Malibu or down in Mexico or something like that. And as a result of that, we kind of had an underdog mentality. And there was one specific break in town that you were not allowed to surf unless you were a really, really good surfer, and that was at the side of what was called the Pacific Ocean Park Pier. And it was an abandoned amusement park built on this pier. And in that pier, there was kind of this little horseshoe bay that was hidden from sight. And the break was basically run by a surf mafia. And it was very Darwinian. If you were good enough, you could get in there and surf. But if you weren't and you went in there without their permission, you might not come out completely whole, because they were very, very serious about, very territorial about what they were doing.
Did you ever get in?
Well, I went in there as a 14-year-old kid one time. I snuck in there with some friends, and I had my life threatened. This guy that ran it said, he goes, if I ever catch you here again, I'll kill you and I'll bury you under the pier. Now, I don't think he would have done that, but when you're a 14-year-old kid and you're told that that's going to happen to you by a pretty mean-looking 21-year-old, you take it very seriously. And so we basically left skid marks in the sand and never came back until we got older and became good surfers and finally were let in.
Now, what about surfing applies to skateboarding? What did you learn surfing that applies when you're on a skateboard?
Well, number one, you're standing up on a moving board, on a moving object. You're not bolted into the board. You're not like roller skates or like snowboarding or something like that, or like snow skis. You're standing free. You can fall off of it. And the motion of it, the type of turns that you do are very similar.
I'd like you to compare falling on a surfboard in the ocean to falling off a skateboard on the concrete.
There really is no comparison. When you fall off a surfboard, you land in water, and it's usually kind of enjoyable. Unless you're, of course, surfing on top of a coral reef, which you can land on, of course. But when you fall on a skateboard, you hit concrete. And you're not only falling on concrete, but you're falling on concrete very, very fast. You're going 20 miles an hour. And you normally slam body first right onto it. So it doesn't feel good. And it the bones don't like it as well, nor does the skin. And as a result of that, we had to learn at a very, very early age, we had to learn to fall, because when we were skateboarding back in the 60s and 70s, there was no such thing as knee pads and elbow pads and helmets for skateboards. And so after falling a number of times and bruising up your elbows and wrists, you start learning that you have to roll, and your roll dissipates the impact. And so that's what would happen. And that's not to say that we didn't have our slams on top of that, because we did. And boy, we took plenty. But it's one of those things, when you love doing something so much, you're willing to pay whatever price there is to pay. So if it meant slamming into concrete, we were willing to do that. And many of us to this day have places on our hips that are completely dead. The nerves have been smashed so many times that they're just gone.
What about you?
Yeah, feeling's gone. There's places on my hip, the hip pointers, that there is no more nerve. There are no more nerve endings.
What was skateboarding like when you guys started? Not what did you do, but what was done before you, so that we could see the difference between what you were doing and what your predecessors did.
Well, skateboarding had a very, very brief boom in the 60s. I think it was in 64, 65. And the kids back then were riding very, very small, little teeny skateboards, very thin, with clay wheels. And clay wheels, if you don't know what a clay wheel is, it's basically a wheel made of rock. And it was, for the most part, what you would call Flintstone technology. It was, they were actually quite dangerous. And so there was quite a limit to what you could do on a skateboard back then. You could do handstands, you could do nose wheelies and basic tic-tacs and 180s and things like that. But you really couldn't ride bank walls and ride swimming pools. And what happened in 1974 is the urethane wheel was developed. And the urethane wheel was basically like a rubber wheel, but it was urethane, very soft, and it gripped the ground. So for the first time on a skateboard, you could ride terrain that had never been ridden before. And as a result of that being invented in 74, and as a result of Los Angeles experiencing probably the worst drought in 100 years in the years of 74 and 75, all of these swimming pools in Los Angeles were lying empty because the government would not allow you to fill your pool with water because of the drought. You weren't even allowed to water your lawn. You weren't even allowed to serve water in restaurants. And so as a result of that, we were able to ride this new type of terrain, which was vertical skateboarding, which had never been done before. It had been attempted briefly in the 60s, but the kids couldn't do anything with it because it was so dangerous on those clay wheels.
When you say vertical skateboarding, you mean like going up the side of a wall?
Yeah, like the pools that are in Beverly Hills and Malibu and Bel Air, the rich neighborhoods in Los Angeles, they have these very deep, 10-foot-deep pools shaped like peanuts or kidneys. And they were beautiful, perfect skate parks for us, in a sense. And we started riding on these. We, you know, there was a couple of abandoned homes that someone had discovered a pool in, and we went into that abandoned home, started riding this pool, and in a sense started developing vertical skateboarding, which I guess many people are starting to say was the beginning of extreme sports. And we absolutely fell in love with this, and at the time realized that we had to keep finding empty pools. And so we would do whatever it took to find them.
Now, one of the things you liked about the pools was that the walls weren't at a right angle. It was a kind of sloping wall, so you could skate up it pretty easily. Well, not easy for me, but I mean, relatively easily.
Well, no, what's unusual is California, especially Los Angeles, has an indigenous type of swimming pool that I'm assuming comes from that kind of the movie star pools. Mm-hmm. They're these beautiful, voluptuous bowls, very sensuous in their shapes, and the transitions, like you're saying, are very, very smooth going up to vertical, where as opposed to like on the East Coast, where a lot of the pools are square and they're actually very unrideable. Well, Los Angeles was filled with these things. In fact, I believe it's the swimming pool capital of the world. So we would go from backyard to backyard looking for all the different shapes of pools we could ride, because each pool offered a different possibility, a different way to expand your abilities, your skateboarding abilities.
Were you caught?
Yeah, we were caught a few times. Yes, we were. I talk about this in the film. There was one time we were caught in what was called the Canyon Pool, and it was right across the street from the actor Peter Graves' house. And he didn't like us skateboarding there because he felt, you know, we were bringing in too much of a bad element into a really nice neighborhood. So they were constantly calling the police on us. And we were actually skateboarding in an abandoned home. It was the home of this kind of California cultural guy named Leo Carrillo. And it was a big estate in the Santa Monica Canyon. And so this one time the cops came and we all hid in the trees. And the cops were looking for us below us, you know, in the trees, not knowing we were hiding up above. And at the time I remember being afraid, thinking I'm going to get nervous. I'm going to probably drop my skateboard and I'm going to knock one of these guys in the head. And then there's going to be real problems. But of course that didn't happen. But they eventually found us. They put us in the back of the car. And they scared us, said, look, you know, we're going to take you down to the police station. You're going to be in big trouble. And then all of a sudden they let us go. Because they realized that what we were doing was pretty absurd. We weren't hurting anybody.
Well, did you worry about the physical consequences a lot?
No, we didn't worry about that. We were aware of it, but we didn't worry about it because we were so hungry to be good at this. I mean, you know, we weren't the guys that were on Little League, you know, base, playing Little League baseball, and we weren't necessarily the guys, you know, getting straight A's in school. And so this was the finally, you know, some of us were good at something in our lives, and we desperately chased it. I mean, because we wanted to be good at this. And we really embraced the act of discovery. We each wanted to be first at doing something. And so all of us had our firsts at certain aspects of it.
What was yours?
I was the first guy to go to able to be able to go to sustain going back and forth, hitting coping to coping back and forth one after the other. Instead of just going up the pool and coming back down and heading into the shallow end, I would hit the left wall and then go to the right wall and literally go back and forth like a pendulum. And if you see skateboarders like Tony Hawk today, that's what they do now. They go back and forth on the ramps, trick to trick. And so I was probably the first guy to be able to do that. And again, we just didn't know if the body could get in these positions and if gravity would allow us to do it.
Stacy Peralta speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with writer, director, and shredder, Stacy Peralta.
The first big skateboard competition that the Z-Boys, the Zephyr team, participated in was in 1975. What was your team doing compared to the other skateboarders?
Well, first of all, that was the first contest that initiated the new modern era of modern skateboarding. And we went, it was in Del Mar, California. We came from Los Angeles. We didn't have any idea if actually people skateboarded outside Los Angeles. So it was a bit of a shock when we got there to just, you know, to see 600 other skateboarders from around the nation. And our skateboarding was based on banked walls. It was, riding banked walls and riding swimming pools. And also it was based on the influence of this surfer in Hawaii who at the time was probably one of the best surfers in the world named Larry Bertelman. And he had a very low approach to surfing and an extraordinarily aggressive approach to surfing.
By low, you mean like crouching?
Yeah, crouching and using his hands, like digging his hands into the wave and pivoting around his hands, like doing what's called a cutback where his board completely does a 180 on the wave and his board is shooting a gigantic rooster tail. Well, that's the kind of skateboarding that we were doing, which was very low to the ground and screeching all over the place and using our hand as pivot points. Well, when we got to Del Mar, we found that most of the competitors were skateboarding, doing the maneuvers that had been done 10 years prior to that, which were the handstands and the nose wheelies. And it was very much the upright approach to skateboarding. And so we came in there with a different approach. And, you know, people said we looked more like a gang, you know, than a skateboard team because we were kind of, you know, we had long hair. We were kind of ratty looking. The back pockets on our pants were all torn off because we were always skidding around that. We were getting so low on our skateboards that we were always scraping the back, kind of the left butt of our pants. As well, our tennis shoes were torn up. So I think we kind of had the look, from what I understand, of like, you know, where Endless Summer meets Mean Streets. it was no longer Brian Wilson anymore. This was a different story. And that had to do with where we grew up, because we grew up in such a kind of a multicultural, you know, environment and stuff like that. It wasn't rosy sunsets and clean beaches. This is where, you know, the smog and the soot, you know, landed in the parking lot, and where you rarely ever saw a sunset that wasn't, tainted with a deep band of smog.
You were used to skating in pools and on hilly concrete. When you got to this competition, you had like a flat wooden surface. So what were the things that you couldn't do in this competition, and what did you do instead?
Well, we couldn't do the type of riding that we were used to doing, which was, you know, the tricks that we were doing on banked walls, which were turning up and down, like surfing, in a sense, surfing on bank walls and doing what's called 180 slides and, you know, pivoting around our hands. So what we had to do is we had to apply that to flat ground. And we did the best we could. A lot of the people didn't quite understand what we were doing because they'd never seen that style of skateboarding before, and there was a lot of protest about it. But nonetheless, we did fairly well. Tony Alva and Jay Adams got third and fourth place. Nathan Pratt got first in the slalom. And Peggy Oakey, the only girl on our team, got first place in the woman's freestyle. So it was basically a matter of trying to somehow transfer that aggressive low style to just flat ground. And it was skidding around our hands and pumping the board and kind of skidding the wheels out and things like that. It's a little hard to describe because I've actually never described it before. So I guess it was just a very low approach, an aggressive approach, as opposed to standing up and doing more like gymnastic tricks.
So what was it like when the skateboarders that you teamed up with started becoming well-known?
Well, first of all, none of us ever had a conception that this would ever lead to anything. So when it finally did blow up after the Del Mar contest, we were all being asked to ride for other manufacturers and being offered quite a bit of money. And at the time, I went from making, you know, being like a busboy in a restaurant, making probably $30 a week, to making 10 grand a month as a skateboarder. And this was in the 70s. I mean, I was making more money than both my parents were.
So this was what, skateboard manufacturers sponsoring you in competitions?
Yeah, what happened is skateboard manufacturers came up to us and they instantly saw the value of associating with us. And so they decided that the best way to make money in their skateboarding products was to put our names on skateboards. And so each of us went to a different sponsor. I went to a company called Gordon & Smith, which at the time was the number one company in skateboarding. And they put my name on four different skateboard models, very much like, you know, the sporting good company is putting, you know, Mickey Mantle's name on a mitt or Michael Jordan's name on a shoe. It was the same type of thing. It was sponsorship. And so they were selling 100,000 of those boards of mine, you know, a year. As well, I was touring all over the world and introducing the sport to kids all over the world who had never seen modern skateboarding other than through these magazines. So we were going to Australia and France and Germany and England. And these kids were just so hungry for this because it was so different, and it was a piece of America that they had never, that they were finally able to grasp and bring to their country.
So you were basically, you know, neighborhood kids who didn't have money, skateboarding, and then a bunch of you became pretty wealthy very suddenly. What did that do to your relationships and to the sense that you were a team?
Well, number one, it destroyed the sense of a team because we were no longer a team. We had all left the original Zephyr team and went off on our own to pursue our own careers. And it was an unfortunate thing that happened, but at the same time, it probably would have been inevitable because there were so many good guys on that team. It's like having the Lakers and the Bulls all in one team. It just isn't going to work. There just is, it's too many mouths to feed. And so at first there was tension because some of us made more money than others. Some of us got more opportunities than others, and it just created unnecessary tension. But in the end, we all became friends again, and we were all, you know, we all became tight. But I mean, I must admit to you, you know, like I said, it was so unusual that this happened, and it happened so fast. I mean, when I was in high school, I was assuming that I was going to be a plumber when I grew up because I figured that would be the only thing I could figure out to do because, you know, there was no future in skateboarding. And so this caught a lot of us off guard. And, of course, it was the 70s, so some of the guys, you know, got a little bit into the rock star thing, and there was drugs involved, and it was very difficult, I think, for some of the guys to handle. They weren't used to making that kind of money, and they weren't used to the fame and attention that came along with it. And it sped up everybody's lives a little too fast at times.
Do you skate at all anymore?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm more relaxed on a skateboard than I am walking, and far more relaxed skateboarding than I am sleeping. And I have an 11-year-old boy, and we have a little ramp at the house, and we skateboard together. It's something I will always do. It's just part of my DNA.
Well, Stacy Peralta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you very much for having me.
Stacy Peralta speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. He's one of the skateboard pioneers featured in the documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys. He's also the screenwriter of a new movie based on the early days of skateboarding called The Lords of Dogtown. It opens next week nationwide.